Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Boy, oh boy, are we in for a real treat today on Triad Arts Weekend. First off, Steinway artist Peter Karoff is back with a brand spanking new edition of Understanding Classical Music with Karoff at the keyboard. He'll shine a light on his idol Johannes Brahms like only Peter can, and he's got a motive. One of today's most exciting young playwrights is 32-year-old Obie Award winner Annie Baker. Her play The Aliens has been called gentle and extraordinarily beautiful by New York Times critic Charles Isherwood, and Paper Lantern Theater Company is here to show us exactly why. Then we're off to Studio A for live in studio action not once, but twice. That's right. Triad Arts Weekend takes the show on the road to Crawford Hall on the University of North Carolina School of the Arts campus for a live recording of trumpeter extraordinaire Judith Saxton and national award-winning organist Timothy Olson in action up on stage. And then we're back in the comfortable confines of Studio A for a truly remarkable duo that's unlike anything you've ever heard. Really, Winston-Salem Symphony principal cellist Brooks Whitehouse and principal bassist Paul Sharp will take us low and lower next on Triad Arts Weekend. The Aliens by young playwright Annie Baker takes place in a back alley behind a small-town New England coffee shop. In it, two 30-something slackers discuss music, philosophy, and Bukowski. While riding the high of shroom-laced tea and acoustic guitar riffs, they write novels and music that the world will never see. The play is also a coming-of-age story about their painfully awkward teenage protege, Evan, and their surprising friendship that ultimately leaves the trio forever changed. Paper Lantern Theater Company launches its fifth season with this Obie Award-winning play. It opened last night, January 17th, in the intimate Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in Greensboro, and tickets are $20. Paper Lantern actor Sterling Hurst plays the role of KJ, Josh Foldy as fellow slacker Jasper, and Owen Hickel Edwards plays the 17-year-old Evan. The Aliens is for mature audiences, and some of the dialogue from the play, which we're about to hear, may not be appropriate for young audiences. Sterling and Owen drop by along with Paper Lantern director Jonathan Brady.
This is the top of Act Two, and Evan has come back from band camp, and he's looking for his new friend to relate his story.
Hey!
Hey! Welcome back from band camp.
Thanks. Yeah.
Did you have a good time?
Yeah, actually. It was pretty cool. I don't know. It was cool. The kids were cute or whatever, and I like... Yeah! The other CITs were cool. I met a girl, actually.
Excellent.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. It was just like a week, but... She was cool. Nicole. Yeah, she's like a violist. I don't know. She lives in Boston, so if I wanted to visit her, I have to drive like 3 hours. So, I don't know. It was cool, though. I mean, it's kind of humiliating that it's taken me this long, but it's kind of humiliating.
Nah, that's beautiful, man. Hey, did you get in your pants? Oh. Sorry, is that inappropriate?
No. I mean... Yeah, I did, yeah.
Great!
17 is kind of pathetic, though, right? I mean, that's happening for the first time, like, now.
There are no rules, man.
Yeah, I mean, when was your first... whatever, kiss, or...
Let's see, my first kiss, I was like 14? It was with this like 16-year-old chick at an Allman Brothers show, and I was totally just tweaked out just to like kiss her. But then she tried to fool around with me in the porta potty, and like my little like, I didn't respond. It was totally humiliating.
Oh, man.
Then I dated this younger girl when I was in high school, and she was like a freshman, and I was a senior, and I think I kind of messed with her head, man. We had sex, and like, now looking back, I'm not sure that she was like totally ready, you know? Then I cheated on her with this girl at a chess championship, and me and her, well, we had like mind-blowing sex, man, or whatever, like me and the chess girl. And then I made the mistake of like coming back home and like telling her or whatever to like get it off my chest, and right after I told her, she, like, crumpled into this little, like, heap on the ground, and she, like, cried and cried, but she stayed with me, and then I broke up with her anyway right before I went off to UVM. So, yeah.
Wow.
Bleak, man. It was bleak.
Let's talk a little bit about Annie Baker, the playwright. She's already, it was a Drama Desk Award. She's gotten nominated for...
Yeah, she won a Drama Desk Award. She, actually, for The Aliens, she won an Obie, which is an off-Broadway Tony Award.
Okay.
For Best New American Play. And actually, she won it for The Aliens and for her play called Circle Mirror Transformation. She won for both plays. She's an incredible, incredible writer, and it's very nuanced. And on the surface, it seems very gentle and very passive. But in actuality, it's been compared to Chekhov. I guess that's the best way of putting it, where it's a lot about the subtext and the rhythm of the piece as opposed to the actual words that they're saying. Like Owen's character says and cool a lot, but there is so much going on in those and cools, it's devastating.
From the actor's standpoint, here, Sterling, chime in on this. How does that impact the way you approach the material? Is it all that unique?
It's definitely unique. It's definitely contemporary. I can see a lot of it bleeding over into, you know, off stage. I try to get rid of when I, you know, me saying like all the time. But, you know, this character does say that. That's part of his personality. It's part of his culture. There's something being said when you do that. You know, when people talk to each other, it's never so cut and dry. There's a lot of things unsaid. They're struggling to get what they want to say out. And it doesn't always come out the way that they want it to. And so since these characters are doing that, and it's kind of in real time, you know, it's not, like this character burst in and everything that he wanted to say was bullet format. They struggle, they stumble over their own words. And so because it is like that, it's very real. It's just, it feels like it's real life. The whole play, it's so real.
Owen, what's going on in your mind when you're filling in those pauses or during the delivery?
The ums and the cools, we have an idea that there is a lot of self-loathing in the things that we say. Like, as you know, you can say one thing, and even if it sounds really perfect in context, you can be inside your head going, oh no, why did I say that? Why did I say that? Why did I say that? And I think the ums and the cools are a fear of being wrong, a fear of being rejected, a fear of saying something that makes you look foolish, because we all have that. We all want to come off, as JB has constantly told us in rehearsal, as Oscar Wilde. We want to be perfect in everything that we say. And I think when you're 17, everything you say is wrong. No matter how smart you are, no matter how cool or charismatic you are, everything you say is wrong, because you're in a place where people are constantly judging you. What school are you going to go to? You know, what major are you going to participate in? You know, what are you going to do with your life? And when you're 17, do you ever have the answer to that? Is it ever that cut and dry? No, it's not. And there is a fear of being wrong, because you're almost censoring your own inner desires. There are things that we can't say, that it's just not necessarily part of our human social construct here, to say things like I love you, or I need you, or, you know, I sometimes get lonely at night, or admit these dark things, or sometimes I feel lost and I don't know where to go. And I think that through this play there's a lot of outreach of that from this character and from all the characters. We're reaching out constantly to be able to say these things without the self-censorship.
Well, it seems like Annie gets a lot of mileage out of truth-telling, you know, and pacing. And have you directed a play like this before?
That's what drew me to the piece. It was unlike anything I've ever directed, and it haunted me after I read it. It's beautiful. It's funny. It's also very thought-provoking. And when you're done reading it and I put the script down, you know, we read a lot of plays, and some just go away, but this one just stayed with me. I have a quote that I'd like to read from Miss Baker, which kind of sums up this play and a lot of her work, which I think will kind of help us out a little bit.
And this is from Annie Baker, the playwright.
Correct. The way human beings speak is so heartbreaking to me. We never sound the way we want to sound. We're always stopping ourselves mid-sentence because we're terrified of saying the wrong thing. Speaking is a kind of misery. And I guess I comfort myself by finding the rhythms and accidental poetry in everyone's inadequate attempts to articulate their thoughts. We're all sort of quietly suffering as we go about our days, trying and failing to communicate to other people what we want and what we believe.
Well, that says a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that way right now when I'm talking to you. You know, I'm editing myself. Am I saying the right thing? Am I doing the right job? Am I telling the story that I want the audience to hear? And it is kind of terrifying, you know, and sometimes language does fail us. But she's got such a fine-tuned ear to the way people speak and the rhythm that it's completely fascinating.
You'll never hear me talk about one day getting out.
My thanks to Paper Lantern Theater Company director Jonathan Brady and actor Sterling Hurst, who plays the role of KJ, and Owen Hickle Edwards, who plays Evan in the Paper Lantern production of The Aliens by Obie Award-winning playwright Annie Baker. The show, for mature audiences, opens Thursday night, January 17th, in the intimate Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in Greensboro. You'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. The Aliens will run through the 27th, with evening performances at 8 and Sunday matinees at 2. Tickets are $20. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a break from our format right now because today we've got a special show for you. Well, you know, every Triad Arts Weekend show is special, but this one, well, let's just call it extra special because we're going to hear not one, but two live performances. About 5 minutes from now, it'll be mind-blowing trumpet and organ music, plus an inside look at the organ, trumpet, and flugelhorn with two of the country's finest, trumpeter Judith Saxton and organist Timothy Olson. And on the second half of the show, we go low and lower with the dynamic duo of cellist Brooks Whitehouse and bassist Paul Sharp. They'll sing, they'll act, they'll bow and pluck and joke, and, well, you're in for a real treat. And speaking of treats, our good friend Peter Karoff is back at the keyboard with a brand new show. It's his up-close and personal take on the use of musical motives in the hands of one of the great masters. Here's Understanding Classical Music with Karoff at the keyboard.
That's music by Johannes Brahms. It's composed towards the end of the 19th century, about 1890 or so. It's beautiful, late romantic, very expressive, filled with kind of longing and nostalgia. But I'd like to just take a little closer look at this music and show you a little bit about how it's put together, because I think it's kind of amazing. Brahms does two things in this piece, and really throughout his musical compositions, that a composer at the end of the 19th century usually just does not do. What he loves to do, just like his hero Beethoven used to do in the beginning of the 19th century, is take one little musical kernel or an idea we call a motive. There's your motive of this piece. And just repeat that motive here and there in ways that you don't even know is there, but somehow ties the piece together. Watch the way this questioning little motive recurs over and over in this piece. Well, there's that motive presented as a melody. The motive also shows up in places where you don't hear it quite as easily in the bass down here. A beautiful, longing melody on top. But underneath it is that little motive reminding us of the question. Here's another fun little technique where Brahms will take the motive and literally turn it on its head so it sort of goes upside down. In other words, before it went down and then up. Here it goes up and then down, and the melody continues in that way. So beautiful. Another fun thing he does in this piece that also is sort of hidden in a way is to take a melody and combine it with itself a little bit later. What does that mean? Well, here's a melody. And those same notes come in just a beat later. Let me just play that again, and this time I'll bring out the second statement of that melody. Did you notice it down there? So that's Brahms for you. It's so beautiful, so romantic, so expressive. At first glance, just in some ways a kind of typical late 19th century construction with a melody and an accompaniment. But always, always, always in Brahms there's something more lurking beneath the surface, some level of craftsmanship that sort of blows your mind when you discover it. You know, I've played these pieces for years, and every time I play some Brahms, or really almost any of these great classical composers, I'm always amazed at the new discoveries that are there. So that's Brahms for you. Beautiful, romantic, filled with longing, filled with nostalgia, and at the same time, filled with a very careful craftsmanship, a very masterful use of all of the musical techniques that he learned from his two heroes, Bach and Beethoven. Johannes Brahms.
That's Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Mr. Peter Karoff at the keyboard with Understanding Classical Music. I'm David Ford, and this is Triad Arts Weekend. And don't move that dial, as they say, because we've got some extraordinary live music for you after this short break. First, recording engineer and producer Eddie Garcia and I toot on down the road to the University of North Carolina School of the Arts for a live in-studio Crawford Hall performance. It'll be awesome organ and trumpet playing in your face, as it were, with trumpeter Judith Saxton and organist Timothy Olson. Judy was subbing with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra when she was just a 20-something college student, and Tim is the first prize winner of the 2002 National Young Artist Competition in organ performance, so they're pretty good. And they're live next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is David Ford, and if you've just joined us and you happen to appreciate great live music making, then you're in luck, because today on Triad Arts Weekend, we've got some of the finest performers in the land who each call the Triad home coming up here in the second half of the show. First, we're off to the University of North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. Everyone likes to be part of an historic first, and this weekend you can do just that with the first ever UNCSA Faculty Brass Quintet and Organ Concert. Sonic Splash will feature UNCSA artist faculty trumpeter Judith Saxton and organist Dr. Timothy Olson. It'll be held in Crawford Hall on the UNCSA campus Sunday night, January 20th at 7:30. From 4 to 6 that afternoon, it's the school's 2013 Brass Symposium. It features a masterclass in Watson Hall with Judy and her UNCSA colleagues, French hornist David Jolly, trombonist John Illica, and tubist Matt Ransom. It's an all-star group of performers providing world-class one-on-one instruction for students from middle school on up, as well as band directors interested in teaching brass better. Participants will receive a free ticket to hear Sonic Splash with brass quintet and award-winning organist Tim Olson later that night. Last week, Triad Arts Weekend recording engineer and producer Eddie Garcia and I interrupted Tim and Judy in rehearsal for a special live-in-studio session. We began with Bach.
This piece that we'll be playing a few movements from on our concert on January 20th is called The Art of Fugue. And really, it probably should be called The Art of Counterpoint, which is the style of writing which Bach wrote in during his period, during the Baroque period. Each of the movements is a fugue, but he also places restrictions on himself on the different movements by adding canons to the counterpoint, the voices that go around the fugue subject, the main idea. And he also changes the subject itself throughout the work. It's ordered in a way that it begins more simply, if Bach can be simple, and then grows in complexity in the way that the piece is constructed musically.
Sounds great. And just for the non-music major out there, the whole idea of fugue, you threw out the word subject in place of the word theme. Maybe you could smooth those over for our listeners.
Sure. The main idea, the melody that you hear at the beginning of a fugue, is called the subject. And if you think about it as a speech, it's the main idea of the speech. And following that, we have an answer. So we have basically a statement followed by an answer, which will sound basically the same thing, but slightly different so that it fits into the key. And then what Bach does is states the subject again. This is standard form of fugue. And then typically the answer again. So in this case, we have four different voices. Call it soprano, alto, tenor, and bass.
And we're talking about contrapuntal writing, lots of sounds going on at the same time.
So each of those voices have their own identity, their own melody. And so counterpoint literally translates as point against point. And so we have melody against melody, or in this case, four melodies against each other, all with their own identity, but also working together.
Hence the name contrapuntkus. We're going to hear a contrapuntkai here. We're going to hear this is. Let's start with the first one, with the first subject, as it were.
Sure. This will be the subject, and then I will play the answer, which you will notice will have the same contour, but just slightly different intervals.
Great. Tim Olson performing the organ here in Crawford Hall in the UNCSA campus. Just as a contrast, and I think a lot of folks don't realize that organ playing is an amazing practice in so many different facets. We've got three keyboards in front of us, but also the feet. Could you play the theme down in those lower ranges here? This is Tim Olson playing with his feet, the subject we just heard. And I just love it when organ players, when they get going with like 16th notes and their feet are flying. Have you ever gotten a foot cramp playing the pedals?
Close to it, yes. Especially in very complicated pedal works and practicing too long, that's what happens and it's not a good thing.
Bring in the trainer. Call a timeout. Okay. So now we're adding Judy to the mix.
So I'm going to be playing the cantus firmus, or the firm song, the strong song is what that literally means, in the upper register of the instrument, while he's dancing all around, playing all the contrapuntai.
Great. All right, here we go. Cantus firmus in the trumpet and contrapuntal writing for the organ. It's just so nice to hear trumpet and organ in this nice hall.
Exactly. And most organists and most organ builders will tell you that the acoustic, or the hall, the space that the organ is in, is the most important stop on the organ.
Well, it's a nice stop, and I'm glad to be here on the campus of the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. Neat program, neat mix of old and new. And what would you all like to start off with here in Crawford Hall?
Well, we've got a piece from a fellow who actually is a dean of the School of Music up in one of the SUNY, State University of New York System Schools. It's called Scherzo and Trio. So, you know, a trumpet and organ pair kind of prompted him to write the piece. And we really like it because it's got some beautiful flowing, smooth, slower lines in the trio section. And the word scherzo literally means playful, and it gives you that feeling of being playful because it changes up the meter from a common time, which would be just like step, 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 step. And then you go into a little bit of kind of some 5-8, 6-8, 7-8 feels, which gives you an uneven step. Bop, boop, beep, bop, 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 boop, beep, bop, bop. So it's really kind of gives you that playful feeling.
Thank you. Great. Okay, so that piece comes to us from 2001, music by Michael Sitton from the SUNY system. What else would be good to play here in Crawford Hall? Kind of give us a teaser for the recital coming up.
Well, one piece that might be interesting is a piece that Judy and I premiered 2 years ago on our first faculty trumpet and organ recital here in Crawford Hall. We had a composition competition for the composition students here at UNCSA, and this piece was the one that we chose, and it's by Ted Oliver, a recent grad now of UNCSA, called Frost and Wind.
Let's just dig in and hear the beautiful sounds of, it's no longer for organ and trumpet, it's flugelhorn. Tell me about that instrument.
Right. We gave Ted the opportunity to choose a couple different instruments, and he chose the flugelhorn. It looks like a pregnant trumpet. It's very big, and it has an incredibly lush, dark, warm, almost fuzzy tone. It's really well known for playing in jazz, but it creates a whole different soundscape for my expressiveness, away from kind of the bombastic bell-likeness of the trumpet, and more into the sultry, more connective, lyrical qualities of this more mellow sound.
As the organ player, I mean, your approach to the instrument, what you're hearing in your head, what you're trying to do when you're playing with a wind instrumentalist?
Well, I think my approach to the organ has always been as a vocal instrument. it is a wind instrument. And we're very fortunate here at UNCSA to have a mechanical action organ, which allows me to manipulate how the speech of the pipes happen and how they begin and how they end.
The mechanical action just more flexible?
You have more control over it because you're physically connected to the mechanism that opens and closes the wind to the pipes.
You just pulled out stop number 8 on the top row there by the top manual. What's that going to do for us?
Well, the 8 that you see on there actually tells us what pitch it's going to play. It's an 8-foot stop, meaning the lowest pitch it plays, which is 2 octaves below middle C. That pipe is about 8 feet long. And it also has a name on it. It says prestant. In English, that would be principal, meaning it's the characteristic or backbone sound of the organ. If you think of the sound of an organ, this is what you would hear.
All right, let's hear it. So are you doing any back and forth trumpet playing? Trumpet,
yeah.
Organ sound, trumpet? Can we hear just one, even if it's just one measure, just to hear the contrast of the organ playing trumpet and then the...
One of the pieces that we're playing with quintet and organ is called Grand Chœur Dialogue, or Grand Dialogue, Grand Choir Dialogue, by Gigou, a French organist. And it was originally written for organ, using the grand choir of really big, loud reed trumpet stops, and then playing against the rest of the organ. In this arrangement for quintet and organ, the quintet is the grand choir, and then the organ echoes it.
To say, when I have my colleagues here, especially with tuba, Matt Ransom on tuba, and John Illica on trombone, and Dave Jolly on horn, and Wade Wiest on trumpet with me, we really can almost really be the same or more than the organ.
I can believe that. Oh, no, here comes Tim. Tim's back with
almost the same.
Okay, we got a little competition brewing here. It was so neat to see. So now I finally figured it out. When you pull out those stops, you're playing in one manual, but it's actually calling the keys from the other two manuals. So you got 3 manuals at the same time. Times 61? Are we looking at 180 pipes at one time?
Not quite, but if I figure each stop that I have pulled on is one represents one pipe for one key. So I can play with one finger or with one foot probably about 80 or 90 pipes at once. So if you multiply that by 5 or 6 fingers playing 2 feet, I can play probably 500 or so pipes at the same time.
That's a lot of pipe. We'll put that in your pipe and smoke it, Judas Sexton. Trumpeter Judith Saxton and organist Timothy Olson. They're artist faculty members at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, and it'll be there that you can hear them in a performance of exciting music for brass quintet and organ during Sonic Splash. Their concert featuring Bach arrangements, new music by UNCSA composition grad Ted Oliver, and much more will be in Crawford Hall on the UNCSA campus Sunday night, January 20th at 7:30. From 4 to 6 that afternoon, it's the school's 2013 Brass Symposium. It's free and open to the public, and it'll feature a masterclass in Watson Hall with Judy and her UNCSA colleagues, French hornist David Jolly, trombonist John Illica, and tubist Matt Ransom. Students from middle school on up, as well as band directors looking to hone their brass teaching chops, are encouraged to participate. They'll each receive free tickets to the concert later that night. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take another short break right now. And when we come back, it's time to get your rosin ready for the dynamic string duo Low and Lower with cellist Brooks Whitehouse and bassist Paul Sharp. You'll laugh, you'll cry, and kiss about 14 minutes live in Studio A goodbye next on Triad Arts Weekend. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and I gotta say I'm pretty proud to be able to introduce our next guests. They're America's number one selling cello bass duo, Low and Lower. Cellist Brooks Whitehouse and bassist Paul Sharp combine their virtuosity with a sense of humor, a touch of theater, and a willingness to try just about anything. Along the way, they've created, inspired, and commissioned new works, and this summer, conductor Robert Moody announced that his Winston-Salem Symphony, Brooks and Paul's day gig, will lead a national consortium of orchestras to commission a concerto for Low and Lower from UNCSA's Lawrence Dillon. You can hear Paul and Brooks live in concert on Tuesday night, January 22nd at 7:30 in Watson Recital Hall on the UNCSA campus. On the program, an eclectic mix of traditional Western classical favorites transcribed just for them, new works composed or arranged by Brooks and Paul, and fun new works by other composers as well. I began by asking the question on the tip of everyone's tongue. Low and Lower, why the pairing? Why bass and cello? How did it come about?
Paul asked me to play on a recital of his when we were both new faculty members at UNCSA. And so, we pulled out the great Rossini duo and gave that a shot. And, it kind of snowballed from there. The Rossini has in it, elements of humor. I mean, he's a very humorous composer, I think, in many ways. And there's a sort of jauntiness and everything, which kind of fed our ideas. And also, there's just in particular in the burgeoning bass repertoire, there's just so much that's interesting and fascinating and funny and theatrical that's going on in developing new repertoire. And hey, as a cellist, I just wanted to take part in it, get in with the gang, The cello itself is not really inherently a funny instrument. It's something that people take very seriously, and they hear it as very close to the range of the human voice, and it speaks to them directly, and they're always asking, what's it like to have that sound up against you when you play? And it inspires deep reflection, and say, well, darn it, I want to do something fun, And Paul was my the door in, I think.
That's great. Well, yeah, so speaking of the repertoire for bass and this expanding performance opportunities for your instrument, I remember junior high driving to Minneapolis in the snow to see Gary Carr with the Minnesota Orchestra, and I'd heard all about him. My best friend growing up was a bass player, and Brad took me out to see him with his dad, and back then that was the pinnacle. I mean, the guy still a legend today, but since then others have picked up the baton. It seems like your instrument's just it is going through a renaissance.
It really is. I mean, part of it is its versatility. And the level of virtuosity in the past 20 years has risen in all fronts, in the jazz, folk, classical arenas. Everybody is just playing so much better. It's like a huge technical explosion has happened in the bass, which doesn't make my job any easier,
Well, let's give them a taste right off the bat. Let's dive in. I've seen little snippets on YouTube, but I want listeners to hear Modern Music Genius. And before we get there, though, how did this piece begin as a Low and Lower special?
I began writing the lyrics about 5 years ago for a skit night at the Center for Chamber Music at Apple Hill in Nelson, New Hampshire, where I teach during the summers. And they have a skit night, and I'm always trying to dream up something to do there. And I started writing it, and it was inspired, by Tom Lehrer's The Elements. I thought, okay, we should be doing one for music. And
Tom Lehrer, Periodic Table, basically he sings the entire Periodic Table
right.
as if it was the HMS Pinafore Patter song, right?
That's right. Antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and da-da-da-da-da, and on and on. Right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. At first, I was thinking, I'm just going to name every famous instrument maker, Stradivari, Guadagnini, and go on and see if I can do an entire song of all instruments makers' names. And I quickly realized that there weren't enough recognizable luthiers' names. You get past Stradivarius and Guarneri and people aren't going to recognize anything. And so I kind of gave it up. And then, 3 or 4 years later, we started Low and Lower. And I thought, okay, this is it. We can do this now. And it can be more generally about music. And so I started writing it again this summer. And then we figured that, Paul could take the chorus refrain and it could become a duo. And, it's been a lot of fun sort of figuring it out.
Well, I've been just in the little rehearsal I've heard so far. I've been doubled over in laughter. I've got my stomach muscles hurt. So let's share this with listeners now. And listen carefully, folks, because these words go by in a heartbeat and you blink, they're gone, but they are hilarious. The lyrics are great. The performance is wonderful. Modern Music Genius, Brooks Whitehouse on cello and Paul Sharp, bassist, live in Studio A. Hit it, guys.
All I am the very model of a modern music genius. I've information serial and polytonal aeneas. I know all the key signatures and mine is Paralelius. I know that when Beethoven didn't bathe, he was the smelliest. I'm very well acquainted with matter shaker radical. I know how to apply to my department for sabbatical. I know that when musicians get together, there's an odium.
Odium, odium. Got it. If they are forced to follow a baton upon a podium.
If they are forced to follow a baton upon a podium. If they are forced to follow a baton upon a podium. If they are forced to follow a baton upon a podium.
I understand important words like arco and agogical. I'm more or less conversant on all matters pedagogical. In short, in matters major, minor, modal, and Bellinius, I am the very model of a modern music genius.
In short, in matters major, minor, modal, and Bellinius, he is the very model of a modern music genius.
I am the very model of a modern music genius. I've played on all the instruments whose prices are obscenious. I've worked with Aaron Copland, Leonard Burns, and Amadori, and I know a guy who plays on a Pacat and a Sartori.
Those are bows, by the way.
I'm very well informed about the instrumental pedigrees. That's Sori Guadagnini and the Galliano families, Guarneri and Amati and the famous Stradivarius.
Stradivarius. Got it. That's not to be confused with Capricorn and Sagittarius.
That's not to be confused with Capricorn and Sagittarius. That's not to be confused with Capricorn and Sagittarius. That's not to be confused with Capricorn and Sagittarius.
They're beautifully crafted and extremely light and portable. And did I also mention they're completely unaffordable? But still, in matters Mendelssohn and Mozart and Rossinius, I am the very model of a modern music genius.
In short, in matters Mendelssohn and Mozart and Rossinius, he is the very model of a modern music genius.
In fact, when I know what is meant by stretto and crescendo, and can deftly grasp the difference twixt colando and morendo, you see, colando is fading away, whereas morendo is dying out. When retrograde inversion needs defining, and I spit it out, when asked what should be done with Yanni's music, I say, sit it out. When I complain you're playing flat and call it total flatulence, when I have spammed the internet with tweets of self-congratulance, when I admit to knowing 97 good viola jokes.
Viola jokes.
Got it. So these 200 violists are on a plane that gets hijacked. And the hijackers demand $1 million for each hostage. And with every hour that passes where the demands are not met, they release another violist. Now, let's see. Viola jokes. Ha! Got it. You'll stay on your patootie because the song isn't over, folks. Musical sophistication, I am quite the pinnacle. Revered by every Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, and rabbinical. There's virtual consensus here, there is no in-betweenius. I am the very model of a modern music genius.
Oh my gosh, modern music genius. You heard it here, folks, and only here on Triad Arts Weekend. That was Brooks Whitehouse, cellist, and in this case, lyricist, and bassist Paul Sharp, and both singing, chiming in with vocals. Absolutely hilarious stuff. And I got to say, you know, right off the bat, going to the viola joke early on.
I would like to apologize here now to my colleague Sheila Brown at UNCSA. We were trying to figure out, and you know, in writing these lyrics, what are the cheapest, dumbest things that somebody claiming to be a music genius would claim to know, and that, you know, that just came up.
So. Absolutely.
Well, from the so that's a little. What I love about this is there's so much like inside ball, but it's still funny. You know, there are a lot of music jokes in there. There's a dig at. I know how to apply for sabbatical. What is that line?
That's right. I know how to apply to my department for sabbatical. Yeah, that's right.
It must have been fun putting these things together.
<That's right. laughs>
Paul, what are you thinking? I can't imagine. I mean, I've tried to divide my brain playing the piano left and right hand, but this is such a beast. What are you thinking of when you're performing this?
It's best if I don't think at all and just let it happen. Maybe there were three times where I remember thinking and I started to go, clenching, you know.
Wait a minute, I can't do this.
A thought cramp. Right.
Exactly.
I'm a flutist for crying out loud.
That's right.
How am I thinking?
But, you know, there's a lot of what we do that challenges us. I mean, you could pretty much say, oh, you're going to juggle on a recital, you know, in 2 weeks. And that's what it feels like, learning to juggle or, you know,
I was gonna ask
ride
that,
a unicycle.
Along the way, Brooks, I mean, do you ever think, wow, this may not fly?
Oh, yeah. Actually, just moments ago, I was thinking that very thought. You know, but It's interesting that most of the play and sing or play and talk stuff that we're used to is like a single person on guitar accompanying themselves. There are several singer-songwriters playing at the piano, you know. But I have to say there's a particular challenge to singing or talking. And we do some slower numbers where we're really singing away at the instrument and really trying to say something, really trying to make a phrase. And I have to say, when you're doing that with a bowed instrument, it's very hard to get a single sound out of your mouth.
I'm itching to hear more. What do you say? Can we get to some more rep from lower and lower?
Please.
What do we got cooking? What do you want to play?
We could do an excerpt from the Benda Sonata that we put this on the program to prove that Benda is not only a late night of debauchery and drinking, but is also actually a wonderful composer. And there's a sonata in F major.
Excellent. Well, we'll go with excerpts. Typically we like complete pieces on our station here, but today we're going to bend to the rules.
Oh, yeah.
I have a musical McNugget for you here. This is all right, here is the presto from Benda's Sonata in F major. This is bassist Paul Sharp, cellist Brooks Whitehouse, live in Studio A. Franz Benda's Sonata in F major, that was the presto, the concluding presto from that work. And bassist Paul Sharp and cellist Brooks Whitehouse. The way you all play it, I mean, it sounds so good. Really, no excuses for the bass anymore. You got to play it in tune and you nail it. You make it sound easy, Paul. Hats off.
Thank you.
Paul, that piece sounds so jaunty and fun. But what? Tell us about, share the challenges of making it sound that way. Because it really sounded so fluid, as if you're... playing it on a violin, on a fiddle.
That's good. I really stress out over trying to make it sound easy and fun because it's very difficult. That piece particularly, I have to play up very high on some of my lowest strings to find fingerings to make work, and that's the kind of the throaty register of the bass.
And those are harder to press down, the thicker strings?
Yeah, they're harder to press down. They're big and flabby, you know? So it's like you're trying to find the string first and then get it down solidly, and it all happens in a millisecond, you know?
Yeah.
And then the bow has to grab it, too. So you've got to use some really stout rosin to make it pop, but then you still have to make it sound smooth.
Hey, let me back up there for the non-musician. Stout rosin, making it pop. What does it mean?
Well, bass rosin is a special category of rosin.
Oh, there's a cult. I've been enjoying watching this.
Absolutely. I mean, we were in Alaska last year on a tour, and we were talking about ski wax and bass rosin in kind of the same breath.
Oh, yeah. Do I use the blue or the green? Yeah.
You know, most bass players have a pouch of like six different rosins, and if the weather is, you know, cold and wet, you use a particular kind, but if it's just cold, then you got to go for the softer stuff, you know. And it, you know, it's glorified tree sap is all it is, but with special stuff added in. In fact, in the Winston-Salem Symphony section, there's a guy named John Spooler, who I'm sure many people know, teaches bass here at Wake Forest.
Sure.
He makes his own special brew of rosin, and we call it stickum in the symphony. There's no other rosin that's stickier, in my opinion. It's great for the Mahler symphonies and the Brahms symphonies, you know, Strauss, you know, when you really want to get after it, you know, you call John and say, hey, give me another one of those special cakes. He only cranks it out like once every 6 months, and he actually sends it out to people all over the nation.
So you put that rosin on your bow, on those horsehairs, and then what does it give you? What does it do?
Well, it just gives you like grit. Without the rosin, that hair just slides over the string. I mean, it's got some natural, the hair itself, bass players have to use unbleached, unrefined hair straight off the horse. Well, I assume it's been washed, of course.
Although I did smell something funny the other day.
It smelled like spring out there.
And we like Siberian hair is best because, you know, the hair that comes off of those horses that live in cold climates, good, stout, thick hair.
Are you serious?
Oh, I'm totally serious.
How about that?
Yeah.
No quarter horse for you. Okay,
that's right.
Good to know. I've got to have more. That we've, in the name of great fun, a piece involving weather that you all do, that can we hear a snippet of that?
Sure.
Be delighted.
Yeah, love to. This is Song of the Weather. I think it's pretty self-explanatory. Get ready to laugh. And this is, once again, we've got Brooks Whitehouse on cello and bassist Paul Sharp live in Studio A here on Triad Arts Weekend.
January brings the snow, makes your feet and fingers glow. February's ice and sleet, freeze the toes right off your feet. Welcome March with wintry wine, would thou wert not so unkind. April brings us sweet spring showers, on and on for hours and hours. Farmers fear unkindly May, frost by night and hail by day.
Who wrote that piece?
Flanders and Swann, the duo from England in the 50s. Yeah, and one of them was a pianist, and both of them sing.
You guys always have your antenna out there for more stuff. When did you come up with the idea for this one for you?
That's
guys?
From my father. My father actually worked for public radio for many, many years in Anchorage, Alaska. Uh-huh. And he has an extensive record collection. A quarter of it is probably organ music. He just loves pipe organ music. Then the rest, you know, symphonic music and chamber music. And then, of course, he has a large section for humor as well. And he would drag out this Flanders and Swann album. And we would listen to it, you know, in the cold, dark nights in Alaska in the middle of winter, and listening to these old English guys singing this song about the weather. So it's always stuck with me. And, you know, just in thinking creatively about things that a low and lower might be capable of or might want to try, that came up. We were on tour in Alaska, and Brooks was staying in my basement looking at all of the albums down there. So, you know, naturally, these things came up and we had to try it.
Brooks Whitehouse and Paul Sharp, Winston-Salem Symphony principal cellist and bassist, respectively, and artist faculty at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. Together, they are Low and Lower, and incredibly, they've really developed an entire new genre in answer to that age-old question, cello and bass, seriously? You can hear them live in concert on Tuesday night, January 22nd at 7:30 in Watson Recital Hall on the UNCSA campus. On the program, it'll be an eclectic mix of music, cello, bass, voice, a sense of humor, and just a pinch of theater thrown in for good measure. Great fun for the entire family. Brooks and Paul are currently busy at work on their new album, Low is the New High, and you'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend, and I'd like to invite you to sit in on our next Live in Studio A session, hear great live music, meet the musicians, the folks behind the scenes at Triad Arts Weekend, and me, David Ford, your host. Coming up next week, it'll be one half of the nationally acclaimed saxophone quartet Red Clay on Thursday, January 24th at 12:30, right here at 88.5 WFDD on the campus of Wake Forest University. Come be a fly on the wall to the sounds of soprano and baritone sax. In the meantime, here's a sample from another recent Live in Studio A recording session.
You know, it's hard to avoid cliche. You talk about the A's and parade and moon in June and that sort of thing. And it can be a difficult thing to say something in a way that's simple and resonates and yet hasn't quite been said before.
I remember green December.
That's Doug Davis and the Solid Citizens. They joined us last week live in Studio A to talk about their new CD. It's called A Pageant of Gold, and Doug and his band will be performing several selections from it live tonight at 8 o'clock in the garage in Winston-Salem. That's all for today's show. The recording engineer and producer for Triad Arts Weekend is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chapin. You'll find podcasts and archived episodes at wfdd.org/triadarts. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. Be sure and tune in next week when I'll be joined by Doug Davis and the Solid Citizens live in Studio A. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.